some of you have more trouble than hearing than others, you know, we're all getting there. So if you can't hear, you know, yell at me or something and tell me you can't hear. And also, as people make comments, which I hope all of you will, I'll try to repeat things so that other people can hear and stuff. And I'm terrible at paying attention to my own time. So when we're done, just, you know, stand up and leave or tell me.
The bell will ring for coffee.
Oh, the bell will ring for coffee. Oh, that'll do it anyway. So welcome. We're going to have a week of studying the book of Job, one of my absolute favorite books, which is kind of interesting because, like all people, when I first heard about Job and everybody said what a wonderful book it was, and then I picked it up and started to read it and I thought, I don't understand one word of this book. Why does everybody think this is such a great book? And now here I am telling everybody that this is the best book in the entire world. I thought I'd give you a little support for my opinion. Here's a quote from Martin Luther.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah.
You gotta bring in the big guys, right, to prove. Luther says of Job that this is magnificent and sublime as no other book in Scripture. And if you're not into Luther, Alfred Lord Tennyson said, it's the greatest poem of ancient and modern times. And Thomas Carlyle, a 19th century historian, said, nothing that has ever been written in the Bible or out of it is of equal merit. So if you, like me, don't understand a word of it when you start, just feel guilty. But it's this... Quite seriously, this is not an easy book, and it's worth the effort to spend time and get into this, but it won't be a one-time thing. How many of you have worked with or studied or read or whatever Job in the past? Oh, quite a lot of you. So are you with me, or are you still at that point where you think this is the most confusing thing you've ever read? Yeah. Don't feel guilty about that. This is kind of a... But it's to invite you in, and if by any chance I try to solve this book this week, don't believe me. It's one of those books that takes you in and gets you deeper, and you have to struggle. It's a lifelong journey, which I think is why Luther and Tennyson and Carlyle also say these things. Why don't we start with a word of prayer? God of mercy, tend us in our suffering, call us in our unknowing, love us in our distress, bind us to those who suffer around us, and bring us to you. This we ask in Christ's name. Amen. So, I don't have to introduce myself because we have these little things that introduce us, so that does it. But lately, because I'm directing the Book of Faith Initiative for the Lutheran Church, the ELCA, I've been running around the church a lot and talking about how to do Bible study, and I'm going to break all my own rules this week, so just in case you think that it's rules about how to do this. A lot of times, I've said to people, well, it's really good to ask historical questions of a book and try to set things in history. The thing about Job is most of those historical questions do you absolutely no good. This is a book for which when it was written and stuff doesn't matter so much. A lot of books it really does matter. But this one you don't. Although I will say only this about it. That probably this book was written in after a lot of the other things in the Bible were written, after a lot of Psalms, after a lot of the prophets and stuff, because Job is playing with other scripture and you can hear it. And we'll sort of see how that works sometimes. It's certainly an old story. And probably Job was a story like everybody knew, the story of this guy who lost everything and still had faith. And then along comes some person who takes this old story and builds a whole book around it. So probably that's how it all came together. There's no, the form, you know, you can't say this is one form or another, although one scholar, Klaus Westermann, said that Job is a narrated lament. So as we read this book, we'll kind of get into laments and think about it. So I have no idea where it was written, though. Here's another guess. It was probably written in the north of Israel rather than the south, because the Hebrew of this book is so difficult that a lot of times nobody knows what it says. So the translators are making things up all the time. So one of the neat things is, I hope when you came in you took Bibles if you didn't have one. There are a bunch of different translations. I'm going to be reading stuff, and you're going to be looking at yours. Maybe not today, because we're in the narrative portion and it's pretty more straightforward. But when you get into the poetry, you're going to look and say, my book doesn't say that. And it's because nobody really knows what it says. How does that make you feel about the Bible? Okay. We're going to get in today to the prologue, but just one more sort of introductory thing. Part of why this book is so complicated is it's so fragmented. We have this introductory narrative section and this final narrative section. We have a lament in three. We'll hopefully get to that today, maybe not. We have these three friends who come and they talk to Job, and it goes in this cycle, and then the cycle sort of breaks down. We have a poem stuck in the middle of it that doesn't belong anywhere, that we probably will never even look at. We have the two answers from God, one not being sufficient. We have two answers from God, two responses from God, and then we have this weird character, Elihu, that appears out of nowhere and talks and then disappears. And you say, what kind of book is this? It's so disorganized. So one of the first questions I want to ask you is this. How many people in this room have, at some point in their life or presently, had an experience of suffering? How many people in this room at some period in their life or presently have had some experience of suffering? I'd be sort of surprised if you hadn't. Was it organized? Did it go in a straight line? Did it make sense? Something about the brilliance of Job is that, as true of that as that is of all of our personal experiences of when life has not gone well, here's a book that mimics that chaos. And it's, if it were more ordered, it wouldn't be true. So I invite you in. I invite you in. So what we're going to do today, and this is, I'm having withdrawal. I didn't give you a handout. I'm not doing a PowerPoint. I'm in a panic. We're going to look at the first two chapters to begin with. So you can open up your books to Job. That might take a little time. And I'm going to read this in chunks. And we're going to ask some questions. And the prologue, that is the first two chapters, are divided into five scenes. And we'll take them once. The first scene happens on earth, and then there's a heavenly scene, and then an earthly scene, and then a heavenly scene, and then an earthly scene again. So we'll kind of take them as they come, all right? So here you go. There was a man. Once upon a time, long, long ago, in a kingdom we don't know about. That's not actually in your text, but there was a man in the land of Uz. You get it? You know, it's like, who knows? There's no land of Uz. whose name was Job. That man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys, and very many servants. So that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. Or maybe your translation says, of a long, long time ago, because the word could be either. His sons used to go and hold feasts in one another's houses in turn. And they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. And when the feast days had run their course, Job would send and sanctify them. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This is what Job always did. Now, I want to say a few things about that, but before I say anything, what do you think of Job?
He's wonderful.
You like Job?
Well, he's amazing here, isn't he?
You like him? What do you like about him?
Well, he does everything right. He's following all the rules.
Okay, he does everything right. So you like him?
I don't know yet.
Okay.
Personality. All right.
What about anybody else? What do you think of this guy?
He loves his children.
He loves his children.
I like that.
Okay, and you like that he loves his children. I'm not setting you up, really. There are no right answers here. Just, you know, really, tell me how you react. Yeah.
As a 47-year-old, your dad is still correcting my driving every time he rides with me. I would really like him to butt out.
Okay, so you're not real fond of this guy praying for his kids. Or, no, not praying for his kids, offering sacrifices.
Offering sacrifices okay. A little of too involved in my life.
Okay. Anybody else?
He doesn't have a wife, or maybe he used to have a wife or a couple.
Yeah, like where's the wife here? You know, she's going to actually show up in the next chapter, and we'll talk about what we think of her. But this, you know, okay.
He's not a risk taker.
He doesn't feel like a risk taker.
Guarded.
He's very guarded. Now, do you like him for that, not being a risk taker, or not like him, or just describing? Just describing. Anything else you want to say about Job?
Jealous.
He's jealous. How come?
What's? A human being is sort of jealous of this guy's Bill Gates of us.
He's not Lutheran. He's not sinning boldly.
Yeah. In fact, what is he doing? What
he's
when you say he's
K-Y-A.
A believer? What?
He's KYA for his butt.
Yeah. So what kind of religious system does he believe in?
Not grace.
Yeah. So how does it work? It's law. And how does the law work for him? I mean, what do you see here? We're using Lutheran buzzwords here. I'm trying to get us past this.
If I do right, I get lots of stuff.
If I do right, I get lots of stuff.
And my kids live.
And doing right means?
Follow the rules.
Well, follow the rules, and the rules are, if my child sins, does
or
something
maybe,
wrong.
Or maybe sins.
Or maybe sins. Mm-hmm. The way I can do this, it's not that sin, he doesn't believe in forgiveness, it's just the way you do that is by sacrifice, right? So there's a system to get through. It's he doesn't not believe his kids can do things wrong. He just is going to take care of it, right? And there's a way you take care of it. So
I don't know about his kids, like are they party animals?
Or right, yeah, okay. So
feast, they invite all, and they invite everyone.
They're having a good time, and he's just worrying that a good time is a little too much of a good time, right?
Is it like people that baptize their kid just in case? Going to church again? Well, just why you baptize him? Just in case.
So getting into Job and who he is, just once more, the narrator, I love narrators because you always have to believe what a narrator tells you in the Bible. In a modern novel, you can kind of not believe that. But the narrator says this man was blameless and upright. Anybody else have other translations for verse 1?
He was honest inside and out, a man of his word who was totally devoted to God and hated evil with a passion.
Wow, is that the message?
Yeah.
Is this version used for perfect?
He was perfect. Actually, that is a better translation. What the Hebrew says is that he was Tam v'Yashar. And Tam, I like to say, Job was a circle and a line. You get the upright part, right? Yashar means upright. Job was upright. The first word, though, is he was complete. He had integrity. He was... So perfect is a better word for that than blameless. The word actually doesn't mean blameless. It means he had integrity.
Is this your first clue that he's a purely fictional character?
Yeah. Well, there is a very once upon a time kind of feel about that. All this stuff, and he's perfect, and absolutely, yeah.
But there's another sense of wholeness, is that it integrates, a wholeness is one that integrates both the negative and the positive.
Huh.
That wholeness, finding shalom is this kind of balance, but I like the word integrated better, because it's, how does all of that fit together for the wholeness of my being? Because
yeah.
I'm whole when I invite in, both when you use Jungian language, my shadow.
Yeah. Outstanding. In fact, seems to me, that one of the that this opening verse is also a question for us. It's one of the questions we're going to live with, and it's precisely that kind of conversation. If you are given to say that this man is a circle and a line who fears God, and fear is another one of those words in we hear fear only one way, but it's got reverence, but it also has terror. It's got both of those things in it. Who fears God and turns away from evil, the question that comes out is, what does that really look like? What is a man who's a circle and a line who fears God and turns away from evil? What would that kind of faith, what could that kind of man look like? And the first, this gives you one picture. And in a way, the whole book of Job is struggling with that and a number of other questions about, so what is it to be a circle and a line? So is it to embrace your shadow? Or is it to sacrifice on the part of your children lest they might sin? And he's got it down to begin with. The rug's about to be pulled out from under him. One more little interesting thing. The text does not say, it may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. This is just fun Hebrew for you. It actually says, and bless God. Because in the text, you dare not put the word curse next to God. So there's a euphemism in the text. It says bless God, but everybody reading this book knows what it means is curse God. So every time it says that, there's this little thing that's going on. Okay, you ready? One day, you know it's a transition because that's how it works. One day, the heavenly beings came to present themselves before the Lord, and HaSatan, the Satan, also came amongst them. All right, so tell me, when you hear that verse, what images come to mind? What do you think of heavenly beings and the Satan? What, you know, angels, heavenly beings or angels, okay, cool.
Pantheon.
A pantheon, yeah. And Satan for you?
Evil.
Evil?
What's he doing up there?
Yeah, so what's he doing among the heavenly beings,
right? What's he doing with
All right, you guys are laughing over there. It's just terrible when your husband's sitting over there with your brother and sister-in-law and laughing at you. You know, it's
terrible. I was the one creating the problem.
Okay.
I said a little guy in a little red suit with a pointed tail.
Oh, little guy, a little red suit with a pointed tail. We got it down. We know what the devil looks like. I mean, don't you bring all that imagery with you as soon as you hear Satan?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
hell, all that, right? So what's he doing with the angels? So are you confused yet?
Yeah.
All right. So it might help to have just a wee bit of help here. That word, and it doesn't actually say, how many of your Bibles say Satan, capital S?
Yeah.
Anybody have anything else?
The accuser.
The accuser. Is that back to the message?
No, this is the Living Bible.
The Living Bible. The Living Bible is never right, and it's right. That is really interesting. It in the Hebrew, it has an article in front of it. It isn't Satan with a capital S, right? Every time this character occurred, not everywhere in the Bible, but here in Job, right? It's ha-Satan, the Satan, all right? And so then you think, well, what is that? So you go and you do a little word search on Satan in the Bible, and you find out that it's a word that is just an ordinary word that can mean accuser or adversary. All right? So here's a quote from 2 Samuel 19:22. What have I to do with you, sons of whatever, that you should today become an adversary to me? Or Psalm 109:6. They say, appoint a wicked man against him, let an accuser stand on his right. And it goes on. It can be a verb even. It can be plural. In Psalm 36, those are my adversaries, my accusers. Somewhere it's a verb. I can't remember where. It's just so it can be that just a verb. And so then you have this figure who is among the heavenly beings, and he has a job description, right? And his job description is to be the adversary or the accuser. In other words, he is the heavenly district attorney. That's his job.
Is he the devil's
advocate? He is the devil's advocate. Ooh. Ooh. Nice. apologies to all the lawyers in the room. And this figure, HaSatan, becomes already in the Old Testament in some of the later versions, like in later places, like in Zechariah or in Chronicles, becomes this satanic figure, this little man in the red. Well, it doesn't go there, but you know, this satanic figure. One of the most interesting places this happens is, you know, Samuel's and Chronicles tell the same history, but one tells it early and one tells it later. And in 2 Samuel 24, this verse comes up about the census. Again, the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he incited David against them, saying, go count the people of Israel and Judah. So God gets angry at the people and tells David to take a census. That same passage in Chronicles says, Satan stood up against Israel and incited David to count the people. Do you hear what's happening here? Inside the Bible, there's a conversation going on about where does evil come from? And is God evil? And in 2 Samuel, God does something that's evil. And by Chronicles, people can't stand it. And they say, no, Satan did it. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So here we are in Job with this figure kind of in between those two moments, right? HaSatan is both a member of that heavenly council, that group of angels that come around God to decide what's going to happen in the world. It's kind of a courtroom situation. And then, so is this figure part of them or over against them? And there you are. Yeah. All right, now I'm going to go back to reading. One day, the heavenly beings came to present themselves before the Lord, and HaSatan also came amongst them. The Lord said to HaSatan, so where you been? And HaSatan answered the Lord, from going to and from the earth and walking up and down it. you know, doing my job, making sure that law's being obeyed, and keeping order. And the Lord said to Hasatan, have you considered my servant Job? There's no one like him on earth, a circle and a line, who fears God and turns away from evil. Then Hasatan answered the Lord, does Job fear God for nothing? Haven't you put a fence around him and his house and all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand now and touch all he has, and he'll curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Hasatan, very well, all that he has is in your hand, only don't stretch out your hand against him. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. So what do you think of God?
Disappointed in him right now.
You're a little disappointed in God right now.
He got poked into doing it.
Yeah,
it's like a deer.
Yeah, a deer or something.
This
right.
is like a bet.
Yeah. Yeah. Might be more of the Olympian gods at this.
Playing
with people. Yeah. Anybody want to defend God? Come on.
God has confidence in Job.
God has confidence in Job. Isn't that interesting? Actually, more confidence that Job has in his own kids, right?
He doesn't have confidence in me.
Yeah, Job. God, with that kind of confidence, I respectfully return the ticket.
Leave me out of this.
Yeah.
It's like the other people don't matter. It's all about Job. So,
So do you, the other people don't matter? Interesting. So, what doesn't this text tell you? Like, why does God take him up, Hasatan? What do you think?
To prove
Satan wrong. Is that worth doing?
Why does he have to do that, though?
Yeah, why does he have to do it?
Yeah.
To prove he didn't put a fence around him.
I mean, you kind of get mad at God. Because you assume, we all assume, that God could have absolutely no good reason for doing this. How could we possibly have a good reason for doing this? Because, look what's happened. The future of the world depended on what man's righteousness. Does this ring a bell? What if the world did depend on God taking up this bet? What if there is something really important that we can't possibly know at stake? It's almost impossible for us to go there, right? Because this is so awful, what he's about to do. It makes us so darn crazy. So what's our question?
Hasatan doesn't put God up to this. That God just said, like, asks what Hasatan's been doing, and Hasatan says, I've been doing my job. And then God says, well, what do you think of Job?
Right.
Hasatan doesn't bring him up.
Right. So this is all like God's doing.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Ooh.
So what's the Satan's question here? Tell me about that question. What do you hear in that question?
Well, I hear him suspecting Job's motives. And this triggers a more modern, relevant experience for me. We have a friend in Vancouver, a nice guy, who says that nobody chooses to do good for true motives. And I happen to do a lot of volunteer work. And he says, Peggy, what do you get out of it? And he drives me nuts. And that's the question.
And that's the question. You've captured it beautifully. It's that there is no possibility of doing something without getting something back for it, right? Without some alternative. So here's our second question. Our first question that the prologue presents us is, what is it really like to be blameless and upright, a circle in the line, the fear of God, turn away from you. Our second question is it possible for anyone to fear and love God without some ulterior motive, without wanting some bad? Is it possible?
Isn't that what this book answers?
Well, does it answer? I mean, you know, this prologue is it's just presenting us with everything here. You know, just what's...
Isn't that our basic theology? God will get you for that. You know?
Yeah, well, maybe. Yeah, and we're not really happy with a God who's going to get you for that. I mean, you know, you hear this, we're a little nervous about Satan being up there with the angels. We're really nervous about God having this conversation and then what God's doing. And then this question, is this HaSatan's question? Is this our question? Our question tends to be a little different. But it's somebody's question. It's
Dan.
This guy's
Dan's
question. It's
question.
Dan's question. We are now going to call it Dan's question.
Is it possible, given this is a human-written narrative, we set aside the divinely inspired question for the time being, that the writer is posing this thing to question who God is instead of God questioning who Job is?
Oh, absolutely. I think, yeah, it's because you can't read this without thinking about who God is, right? You're just right there. You're right there worrying about, am I going to really worship a God who's going to come and squish me? Help. For what reason? Because he's going to take on a bet with HaSatan? Oh, great. And notice we always want the reason. All right? We might worship God if we think God's got good motives.
And now we got God's
right?
motive.
And we can go by. But if we can't figure out what those good motives are, so what are we really worshiping? We're worshiping our understanding of what good motives are. Right? So hence HaSatan's question. Does anybody worship God for no good reason? Okay, let's keep going. All right. One day, transition. When his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the eldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, the oxes were plowing and the donkeys were feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell on them and carried them off and killed the servants with the edge of the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven. You'll notice it's earthly enemy, then heavenly, then earthly, then heavenly. While he was speaking, another came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another came. The Chaldeans formed three columns, made a raid on the camels and carried them off and killed the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you. And while he was still speaking, another came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind, spirit breath, came across the desert, struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. Then Job rose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell on the ground and worshipped. And he said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin nor charge God with any wrongdoing. So anything you notice, want to say?
He's got four guys left.
Four guys.
One that each told him.
Yeah, four guys left.
What if all those servants were good worshiping people?
Right. You notice the servants? You notice how many times the servants get
slain, like the edge of a sword.
In all of them. And what's also not available in translation is when it says, and it fell on the young people, meaning his children, it's the same word as the word for servants. So this, watch those servants, because we tend not to pay any attention to them.
They're a bunch of people.
So there they are, they also are part of this. You almost don't, it's so easy not to notice them. And they keep dying.
Mm-hmm. This makes me think of the movie Slumdog Millionaire. Is that the name of it?
Yeah. How so?
We went because that was the big thing to look at. And when we watch all these car chases, or James Bond movies, that latest James Bond movie too, these car chases and they're racing through things, and all these people are getting killed right and left over racing around and doing things, and that's not the point of the movie. The point of the movie is the bad guy chasing the James Bond or whatever it was in the other movie. And Dwayne and I sit there feeling sorry for all those people that are getting killed in that stupid movie. We don't do well at that kind of movie. It's just like this.
So you watch this. And now Job. Think about Job. What do you think of Job now? And what do you think of Job's speech to God?
It's a little unbelievable. I'd be angry.
Yeah. Like, where's your anger, Job? So do you think this is good speech? Is this pious speech?
He isn't very emotional, except for the ripping of his robe.
Yeah, but those are actions. Those are rituals to do when something bad happens, not the actual heart ripped out of your crying. There is an emotion. Does the ritual. Okay, now I'm shameless.
He just
You're
wants
still
to... Still
follow the rules.
He seems to consider the servants and the children and the camels and the property all as equal things that he had and then he didn't have.
All these things are gone. All these things, the property, the children, the animals,
it's all
although it does build to the children, doesn't it? I mean, that's that last piece.
Right.
But there's no more reaction for them than anything else.
Than the camels.
Than the camels and the sheep.
Well, he's going to have time to react because they came one after the other.
While he was still speaking, yet another came. Anybody up there in the balcony, you're allowed to talk. Just want you to know.
I have a problem with in God taking away.
Yeah.
We lost our 37-year-old son with a 6-day-old baby. Mm-hmm. I have a problem with that statement.
Yeah. So one of the things that this piece raises is, what is pious speech? What is reaction? You read this. You read people talking about the faith of Job, and they invariably quote this thing. And one of the questions of the book will be, so what is pious speech? What is the right reaction? Is it this? And you're saying, excuse me, not a chance. That's not. So is the narrator toying with us? In all of this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrongdoing. Right?
Is
that what pious speech is?
Yep. Is it very different than what happened in the beginning when all was well? And out of good habit, he did what was practical and
right.
And
so he has
it. Now, why not turn to God just in case, because that's all that's left?
Right. So it is that's really helpful. It is falling back into the speech and practice that he's been speaking and practicing as a good and righteous man his entire life. And so he says what the tradition has invited him to say.
Is
isn't the kind of person that I think I, at this, he seems so reasonable.
Right.
And so practical, that if I were going through a trauma, that probably wouldn't be the person, I would want somebody who would weep and cry with me, not give me practical, reasonable explanation.
Absolutely.
I'm a little annoyed that he's so reasonable.
Yeah.
He's also a part of that tradition. He's totally in that box. It's a totally patterned response.
It's a pattern response. He's in a box. Yeah, yeah.
When he says, naked came I from my mother's womb, and naked I shall return, it's true.
Right.
Yeah. It's reasonable.
Well, he's
not simply pious. There is some truth. There is some truth.
And why do we have to presume that he's not deeply affected by this? I don't see any reason in the text to not presume that when he got to his feet, that he wasn't crying out, and that when he's ripping his robe, and he's not weeping, and when he's shaving his head, he's not accidentally cutting himself just to know that he's still alive.
Yeah, you know, I think really, that's really helpful. That it's how we read that. This does not mean he's not feeling. It means we don't know. We don't know from the text how he's feeling. Yeah, yeah.
Is it possible that at this point of the story, the reader, the listener, has been thrown into the role of Hasatan?
Oh, yeah, I thought you were going to say into the role of Job.
No,
yeah.
The role of, you would be, you have become part of the text right now.
Yeah, so which are you, God? Are you Hasatan? Are you Job? Are you one of those unnamed servants? Yeah.
I wonder, would this be an accepted pattern of mourning during that period?
Oh, the tearing the robe, shaving the head, falling on the ground and worshiping. That would be pattern of mourning. There's no question about that.
So that wouldn't be out of the ordinary.
No. That would, but that doesn't mean it's not heartfelt. I mean, are we to say every time we come to church and do the ordinary, we're not feeling? I mean, I hope not. So to fall into the ritual pattern is not necessarily bad, but it is, in fact, what he's doing. Okay, we're going to go on. All right. One day, back in heaven, the heavenly beings came, it says literally, the sons of God, came to present themselves before the Lord, and Hasatan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Hasatan, so where have you come from? And he answered, from doing my job. And the Lord said to Hasatan, have you considered my servant Job? Have you heard this speech before? Mm-hmm. There's a pattern in this book of repeating things twice, and that's Hebrew poetry. You always say once and then twice. And it's the twice is always a little different. So you're always watching for what the twist is in the B part of the A. Never mind. Okay. Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one like him on earth, a circle and a line, who fears God and turns away from evil. He still persists in his toneness, in his circleness. That word for integrity there is the same word that is blameless. Right? So he still persists in his wholeness, in his integrity. Although, says God, you incited me against him to destroy him for no good reason.
It was a dare.
Whoa. Then Hasatan answered the Lord, skin for skin. All the people have, they will give to save their lives. Just stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to the face. And the Lord says to Hasatan, okay, he's in your hand. Only spare his life. So, what question now comes out of God's speech?
There's Who a is new... this God?
Who is this God? And what do I have to do with him?
Yeah. But honestly, who is this God? He's not the God of the New Testament, is he? Is he a God of love here? He's victimizing this poor guy just to get... I don't even know why, to prove himself to Satan? I mean, if we're going to make a characterization of this character, of God, what is he doing? He's victimizing somebody just to prove himself to somebody else. Is that a God I want to believe in? I'm not sure.
You got it. You got it.
We have a problem.
We have a problem. We have a God problem. have a God problem. Because this is not the God we want.
Make that speech in the cancer ward.
Yeah, make that speech in the cancer ward. This is Job getting to you. If you don't feel that way about God, you're not listening to this book. It's like, what in the world is going on here?
Exactly.
And I don't know if I want a part of it. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And what's God's, underneath God's question, when he says to HaSatan, you incite me against him to destroy him for no reason. What would be a reason?
Bad things happen to good people.
Bad things happen to good people. Beneath this question is an assumption that there might be a good reason. Right? That in fact, bad things should only happen to bad people, and good things happen to good people. And that we want the world to make sense according to justice, where good things happen to good people and bad. So beneath that question, you incite me to destroy him for no good reason, is that maybe there might have been a good reason, right? If he had not been a circle and a line who fears God and turns away from evil, then maybe this whole story we could have handled, right? If he had been an Islamic terrorist who had just blown up the Twin Towers, we maybe wouldn't feel that way about God. But this being about Job, we have a slightly different reason. So one of the other fascinating things is that word for no good reason. The word is hinam in Hebrew. It's exactly this word that HaSatan said is, does anybody worship you, God, for no good reason? Did you destroy him for no good reason? We have another major question in front of the house. The question of unjust suffering. Why do good people suffer? And kind of underneath that is, why does anyone suffer, and why do we think that there's a difference between good people suffering and bad people suffering? Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Enter JB's character. If God is God, he is not good. And if God is good, he is not God.
Right.
And it's going to hound him.
Right. So this question of goodness and deserving, we are now set up this whole prologue. Who's God? Why should I worship him? Can you worship God for no good reason, even when you're totally ticked at him? For good reason? What's it like to lead a good life? What does that look like? Why do the innocent suffer? And what does pious speech really look like and sound like? Do you feel those questions coming out of this prologue? They're all there. They're all there. And so HaSatan went out from the presence of the Lord and inflicted loathsome sores on Job from the sole of his feet to the crown of his head. And Job took a potsherd with which to scrape himself and sat among the ashes. By the way, he's now a leper. He's now unclean. And then his wife said to him, do you still persist in your circleness, in your toneness, in your perfection, in your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women who speak. Shall I receive good from God and not receive the bad? In all of this, Job did not sin with his lips. So what do you think of the wife?
I think it's interesting that when God took everything from Job, he didn't take his wife.
Yeah.
She's still there to hang. Yeah. He's going to miss her.
That's great.
Someone had to be there to nag him.
Someone had to be there to nag him. So I'm back to this. What do you think of her speech?
Well, he had to denounce her. God didn't have to take his wife away from him. He did it himself. He denounced her.
Yeah, he does. That's right. And so he does God's job for him, and that.
Well, it's kind of like she's speaking the anger that all of us are having in this.
Yeah, you know, interesting.
She's like, come on.
Get a life, Job. Get mad.
Like she wants to curse God.
So what she wants, one of the things that's totally fascinating is you get that. You know, Job's supposed to be the good guy. He condemns his wife for saying get a life and get mad. And he becomes her in the rest of the book. Right? But in the prologue, he becomes the friend and tells her she's a foolish woman. You with me on that?
Can you say it again?
Okay. You read this, and she says, do you persist in your integrity, curse God, and die? And he says, you're speaking as a foolish woman. He judges her speech, right? He judges her speech as being unpious, ungood speech, right? Mm-hmm. How dare you say that about God, right? That's what he says. And because Job is our hero, we kind of let his speech about his wife sound like it's true. But what if his wife is setting the stage for what Job's now going to do the whole rest of the book? And Job is actually right here acting much more like his friends are going to act to him. You with me now? We'll get there. We'll come back. And that lovely, and he did not sin with his lips, whereas in the last one, he didn't sin or charge God with wrongdoing. You know, it's getting a little skin deep. We don't have much time, but I wanna read what happens next. Because, well, first of all, his friends come and sit with him for a week and don't say anything, which is their very best moment. actually, it's not even their very best moment. It says in the law, in Leviticus, that when someone is a leper, that's what you do. You go and sit with them in silence. Before you do any accusations or anything, you sit with them in silence for a week. It's a great moment. We're going to do the friends tomorrow, so I don't want to pass by their best moment, really. Just speaking of tomorrow, we're going to think about Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar and Elihu. And if you like homework, this is only if you like homework. You can read all of Job if you want, if you really want homework. If you like just a little homework, you could take one of the characters and be Eliphaz, or be Bildad, or be Zophar. He only has two chapters, so that's only two chapters to read. Or be Elihu, who is a really weird friend. And read just one of the characters and feel like what it's like to be them. And we'll come back tomorrow and we'll think about who these friends are. So, but I wanna, in the last 5 minutes, just show you, we're thinking about what pious speech is. Now let's think if this is pious speech, because we leave the prologue and we enter the arena, and this is what Job says. And I think I'll kind of comment as I go. After this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. He said, "Perish the day on which I was born, and the night that said, a man-child is conceived. That day, let it be darkness." Does that resonate with you? Not that day, let it be light. This is reverse creation here. Right? That day, let it be darkness. May God not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness reclaim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the eclipse of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come in the numbers of the month. Oh, that night, let it be barren. Let no joyful cry come into it. Let those who curse the day or curse the sea, there's a pun there, on day and sea, which is a close word. Curse it, those who are skilled to rouse up Leviathan. That's the chaos monster, Leviathan. The uncreation, the chaos monster. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light that never comes. May it not see the eyelids of the dawn, because it did not shut the doors of the womb, nor hide misery from my life. Why did I not die from the womb, come forth from the womb and expire? Why were there knees to receive me, or breasts for me to suck? Now I would be lying down and quiet. I would be asleep. Then I would be at rest. In creation, in Genesis 1, creation goes towards Sabbath, towards rest. And here he's saying, the only thing that would give me rest is uncreation. Is there not being any light, no being stars, no being day, only darkness and unbirth. Now I would be at sleep, then I would be at rest, and only then would there be the equality of Sabbath, with kings and counselors of the earth who rebuild ruins for themselves, or princes who have gold, or fill their house with silver. Oh, why was I not buried like a stillborn child, like an infant that never sees light? There the wicked cease from troubling. There the weary are at rest. There the prisoners are at ease together. They do not hear the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slaves are free from their masters. Why is light given to one who cannot see the way, whom God has fenced in? For my sign comes like my bread, and my groanings are poured out like water. Truly the thing I fear comes before upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes. So the question I leave with you is this more pious speech than his speeches in the prologue? And if so, what makes it that? It's honest. What is it to love and fear God and to be a man of integrity or a woman of integrity? What's true speech to God like? And it's one of the things that we'll be thinking about and struggling. Any last comments or thoughts before we break for the day?
Well, what if Job knows that the true life of God is not, I mean, we're so bound in our humanness and tied to this earth that we do not fully realize that the true glory of God is pre and post, pre-creation, post that. And that to never have been born would have been in that place with God. Hmm. Does that make any sense?
So this yearning for rest, this yearning to be unborn.
Right, is because you are back in that place where, I mean, right. God's realm is larger than this earth, but as humans, we almost can't right. see.
But of course, that's very unincarnational.
Definitely.
You know, that life then is just a veil of tears, and why bother? That true life is with God before we're born and with God after, and this is just this minor little thing we're going through down here.
But maybe for a reason. We don't understand. We don't know.
Yeah. So, but that's another one of the struggles that's there. The struggles that presents us. Is Job's lament true because of his feelings, or is it good theology? Or, you know, which one's going on here? And it's like, it's one of the struggles. When we get back tomorrow, then we'll review the questions that are going to be in our minds as we look. And I invite each of you to take on the character of one of the friends if you're not. And if you don't, just come. We'll do it. And we'll think about how they respond to all of this. Then the next day, we're going to think about how Job responds to all of this. And then we'll get back to God. Okay, thanks.